The turning point in relations, that is how the Iranian president has described his visit to Moscow, in a visit at the personal invite of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Raisi, who has already held a one-on-one with Putin, has said that Iran intends to enhance cooperation in a variety of fields like military and trade. In this edition of The Spotlight, Iran-Russia relations will be the focus and also a look at why Iran's president is one of the only presidents of another country to address the Russian State Duma.
Iran's president is in Russia on his most significant trip abroad since taking office in August last year. The historic visit offers the two countries a good opportunity to deepen their ties. In a meeting on Wednesday, Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, agreed to work to further enhance bilateral cooperation in various fields.
We can promote our relations in the economy, trade, on the political track. We have no restrictions and nothing holds us back from further developing our ties with friendly Russia. We are not talking about momentary relations, we are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
The Iranian president also said that the two nations have an exceptional opportunity to join hands to counter U.S. unilateralism and its sanctions policies.
We are living in extraordinary times when we see efforts to counter unilateral actions by the West, including the United States. We can create synergies in our efforts to work together with one another. For more than 40 years, we have been deterring the United States.
The Russian president also said that Tehran-Moscow relations have been constantly improving.
Despite the pandemic, in 2020, we had a very slight increase in trade, and last year, we saw an increase of 38%.
Tehran and Moscow share common views on geopolitical issues in West Asia, which is already facing numerous challenges, ranging from war and military intervention by some regional and extra-regional powers to economic instability. During the visit, Raisi presented Moscow with a draft version of Iran-Russia 20-year cooperation agreement. He told Putin that the document outlines a roadmap for the two countries' cooperation for the next two decades. It seems that Tehran and Moscow are on the path to capitalizing on their political solidarity and expanding relations. They are also looking for consolidating their ties with other countries in the East to build a united front in the face of the West's ever-increasing hostile agenda in the region and beyond.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have John Basnich. He is a journalist, activist, and political analyst who joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at the LaRouche organization, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. And John Basnich, I'm going to start with you. This visit by Iran's president to Russia has been deemed to be an important one, and it has come at the invitation of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Why is this visit considered to be as important as it's sounding to be?
First of all, it comes at the ideal time for such a meeting of leading heads of state, especially leading heads of state who are both under pressure from the United States and its NATO allies. This is a meeting that has been long been awaited to take the relationship between Russia and Iran to the next higher level. And that means greater integration, greater support, and greater interreliance in opposing American dominance through unilateralism, which actually translates to the wanton use of military force.
Greater American, I think you said dominance, to push back against unilateralism, correct?
Unilateralism, and unilateralism translates into war.
Okay.
That's what we're facing from America.
So I want to take that phrase and get your reaction as to whether you agree, Harley Schlanger, with that or not, and explain a little bit further what that means, really.
Well, I agree exactly with that. The unilateral doctrine of the United States since the end of the Cold War in 1990-91 has been that America is a unipolar power, and that because the United States supposedly won the Cold War, it has a right to impose its policies on every nation. Now, what we're seeing is a rebellion around the world to that, which includes the Russian and Chinese at the leader, in the leadership of that, pushing for a Eurasian integration policy to counter the American NATO military force. Now, this is something that the American leadership, and by American leadership, I don't mean the American people. I mean the bankers, the insurance companies, the war machine that controls policy in the United States, they are intending to impose a global order based on Western financial policy. And Russia will not submit to that, China won't submit to that, and neither will Iran. So the potential exists for a counterpole to that. And the more the US and NATO push toward war, the stronger the counter-alliance becomes.
It's very interesting how this military alliance is forming and being enhanced, John Busnish, in a sense, between Iran and Russia. This trip has been something that both presidents have talked about, the enhancement of their military or defensive cooperation. And it comes at a time where just days ago there was an announcement made that there's going to be Russia-Iran-Chinese war games that are going to happen. And it goes back to what you said, which comes at a pivotal time when the U.S., NATO, I mean, the U.S. should really just, the initials should be part of NATO, I guess. But anyways, the two are pushing against Russia, and the U.S. promoting this idea of war based on a false pretense that Russia has said. What does this three-way military exercise, or what kind of message does that send to the U.S.?
Well, I think that this is the smartest move that Iran, Russia, and China can continue to be making, and that is to band together to protect each other. The United States operates in a very cowardly way by attacking a lone, relatively defenseless member of the opposing side, and they decide who the opposing side is just based on only on their own interests. And what the United States routinely tries to do, not just in military affairs, but even in political affairs with its own allies, like Japan, like Germany, America isolates these of its own allies who do not follow orders to the letter. Now, if that's what they do to their allies, can you imagine what they're doing to Russia, Iran, and China? And therefore, for the simple means of survival, Russia, China, and Iran are banding together, and they are creating a center of power which can only grow as more and more independent sovereign countries realize that their sovereign safe in the hands of the United States.
Well, one of the things that is a common and shared thing that Russia and Iran have, and that is the way that the U.S. sanctions has been weaponized by the U.S. against both of them. And, of course, one of the things that they both want to capitalize on is increase trade. But one of the main aims is to push for de-dollarization. They've already started that. They do their national currency and their bilateral trade. But that needs to be taken a step further, Harley Schlanger. Russia and China announced a new infrastructure for financial system to bypass SWIFT. Do you think that all of these will actually make this de-dollarization become a reality?
Well, I think the more the U.S. pushes sanctions, which in our opinion are war crimes, you can kill people in some ways more efficiently by cutting off credit, by cutting off delivery of food, delivery of medicine. That's what the sanction system is. The Caesar sanctions, for example, against Syria, or the freezing of funds that belong to the Afghan people. That's the kind of dirty game the U.S. and NATO are playing. Now, it's interesting because the Germans are starting to move out from under that. There's a very important article in Handelsblatt today, the German Business Daily, which said that it would be a mistake to kick Russia out of the SWIFT system because of the damage that would do with the European trading partners of Russia and China. In the meantime, the Russia-China alliance is not just military. It's based on expanding the influence of the Belt and Road Initiative. It's based on energy, including oil and gas, but also nuclear power. And it's an ideal connection with Iran to bring Iran into the Belt and Road Initiative. I don't know if you know this, but Syria just this week signed an agreement to join the Belt and Road Initiative. The importance of the Belt and Road Initiative is that it's not controlled by the dollar, it's not controlled by London and Wall Street, and it represents an alternative approach to economics, namely investment in production, not in speculation. So I think the idea of Russia, Iran, China, maybe India will be a part of this because Putin was recently in Delhi for meetings with the Indians. You're actually beginning to see a shift away from the control of the narrative by the City of London and Wall Street and Washington toward the development of sovereign nations.
Well, you have had Iran actually try to capitalize on what it is now becoming very apparent, and that is this looking to the east. We know that the implementation looking to the east. We know that the implementation stage of the 25-year China agreement, John Basnich, was just announced days ago by the Iranian foreign minister. You have this trip that's being made by the Iranian president to Russia, which again cements their ties, especially when it comes to trade. You have Iran part of the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Russian president just in his bilateral meeting with the Iranian president said, you know what, you also need to become one in the sphere of this Eurasian economic union. So my point being is you're having this eastward push, and that kind of doesn't, in a sense, show the U.S. failure in its foreign policy. We have all these countries pushing towards Russia and China and their alliances there.
You know, there's a sort of a common saying in English that goes like this. If all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if the United States has basically only a military-industrial complex at the core of its economy, then they must push for conflict. And so long as they were the only bully on the street and that they were ready to use their forces, have support from England and France and other countries, then there was no problem for them. But now we've got Russia and China and serious military power, and we're seeing Iran developing its own national defense. I think we're going to see a real steep learning curve for the leaders of the United States here. In the past, the United States could do whatever it wanted because it did not care. Its leadership, it's a small clique that leads the United States. Its leadership had nobody to answer to because they controlled the media completely. With international media like yours, like Russia Today, like Chinese media, like other media that are coming up on the internet and on people's phones as they walk to and from work, the picture of the world is changing. And so long as America cannot control the picture of the world, they can no longer ignore what other people think of them. And this is where China, Russia, and Iran working together can show the world that solidarity can stop aggression by America.
Well, one of the places that the union of Russia and Iran proved to be very successful, Harley Schlanger, that is in the case of Syria. And when it comes to that, the message that sends the U.S. in some sense should be that they're not going to be able to help the regional countries when you have Russia and the security cooperation that exists between Russia and Iran, for example. Do you think that countries in the region are taking note of this? We know that, for example, the U.S. claims it wants to pull out of the West Asia region, or Middle East, as others call it, but others say no, it's still going to be there. But how does it look when countries see Iran and Russia enhancing their especially military ties?
Temple showed the limits of U.S. military power. The U.S. has dominated, and not so much because of the military power, because outside of the large invasion force that was sent into Iraq and Afghanistan, they're using tactics such as color revolutions for regime change, sanctions, and so on. But when the Russians came into Syria and showed that they were not going to allow the United States to overthrow the Assad government, the U.S. failed. The U.S. is still there trying to take oil and impose sanctions. But what happened was it exposed the fact that the U.S. was behind the so-called Islamic terrorist movement, the so-called moderate rebels, really ISIS and Al-Qaeda, backed and trained by the U.S. Now, another example of this is what just happened in Kazakhstan, which is a very large country. It's not highly populated, but it has a lot of raw material wealth. They tried a color revolution there, including bringing in jihadists from Syria, from Iraq, and from Afghanistan. But the Russian forces came in very quickly and crushed the rebellion. And what Putin said is, we will not tolerate color revolutions. So the lesson of Syria, the lesson of Kazakhstan, and now we're seeing in Ukraine, and just a quick word on this, there are people in the United States, including inside the establishment, who are coming face to face with the reality that Putin is not bluffing, that he's very serious. He's insisting that there be security guarantees to protect the Russian people and the Russian nation. And the U.S. can threaten to kick Russia out of SWIFT. If they do that, it will harm the West. They can threaten retaliation. Who is going to take the risk of losing a country in Europe to defend a Ukrainian regime which is corrupt and includes in it neo-Nazi elements in the defense and security forces? So in this case, the Russians are holding a good, strong hand. The alliance with China makes it even stronger, because now the American military fears that if they go to war with Russia, it's going to be Russia and China. And then adding Iran, look, Iran played an extremely valuable and important role in defeating the color revolution insurgency inside Syria. Mm-hmm. And I think people in the West recognize that, and it shows that Iran, when necessary, is capable of defending the interests not only of its own country, but of the region.
So it's like pieces of this puzzle, John Busnish, that if you put them together, it kind of shows that the U.S. is not only outstretched, but is ineffective. And I'm talking about the West Asia region, because there's also this Persian Gulf security, collective security plan that has been proposed by the Russian Federation. Iran has its own proposal also, but together, really, it's about having taking the security in their own hands in this area. Does the U.S. then, is it calculating all these different things that are happening when it comes to these alliances that are getting stronger, like Iran and Russia, in how it's conducting itself in the region?
You know, I repeatedly say this when I discuss the way international political affairs are governed on America's side. I worked in Washington, and I'm very familiar with how these decisions are made. They don't actually care if they make mistakes, because the mistakes in pressuring other countries to do what they order them to do can only lead to war, which also helps the American economy, because the American economy is still a war-based economy. So they don't care about whether something is a mistake or not, because if they cause damage by pressuring a country or sanctioning a country, or if they cause damage by bombing a country, either way they're achieving their results. And this is why what they do and what they say has to be analyzed from people, especially people like myself, who was born and grew up and educated in the West and worked in government in the West and saw from the inside the criminality of the basic approach of the Anglo-American Empire. We have to speak out. Because if we speak out and we join the people of Iran, the people of China, the people of Russia, and other people around the world, the loudness of our voice should be enough to wake up the American people who are in just a deep slumber under the control of their own government.
Final question, Harley Schneider, goes to you, and I have to ask this question, at least because our reporter said that everybody in Russia, all the reporters there in Russia are talking about this. Chairman of the State Duma attended the inauguration ceremony of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. And now you have the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, at the invitation of Putin, one of its items on its itinerary is to address the State Duma. How important is that when you don't really recall the last time a president of another country addressed the State Duma?
Oh, it's very important. I mean, it shows the degree to which Russia is looking to Iran, not just as a regional player, but as we've been discussing, as part of an alternative security architecture. One of the things Putin has been stressing is that we need to change the security architecture. And what that means is break the power of what John just called the Anglo-American Empire. Remember, the Anglo-American Empire is based on a British notion of geopolitics, which means there must never be union between European countries and Eurasia. But we're seeing now in Ukraine, we're seeing it in the so-called Middle East, a fight where countries are beginning to recognize that Eurasian integration makes sense for them. So being brought into the Duma is a very important body. Russia is emerging as a real international power. And the honor given to the Iranian president is just a reflection of the potential for this new order that's not controlled by the unipolar forces in Washington and London, but actually represents the interests of the vast majority of the world's population. So I would say this is extremely important, and I give my congratulations to the people of Iran for this kind of recognition.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it on that note. Harley Schneider, spokesman of the LaRouche organization from Potsdam, Germany. John Boston, it's a pleasure. Thank you for your contribution. Journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. For me, Kevin Tagli, it's goodbye. Until the next program.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. We must read the Holy Quran with contemplation. In Surah Qasas, Ayah 79, we read, So he emerged before his people in his finery. Those who desired the life of the world said, "We wish we had like what Korah has been given. Indeed, he is greatly fortunate." This ayah is about the people who make comparison between themselves and the people who are wealthier than them, and that's why they feel unfortunate. However, in ayah 80 of the same surah we read, those who were given knowledge said to them, "Woe to you! Allah's reward is better for someone who has faith and acts righteously, and no one will receive except the patience." As you can see, there are two types of people in these two ayahs. The first ayah is about the people who look at Korah and compare their financial conditions with his and feel unfortunate. Still, there is a second group in the second ayah who have faith in Allah and wait patiently for His rewards. This second group do not compare themselves with Korah in terms of financial matters and are surely more patient and calm inside their hearts. Unfortunately, in today's materialistic world, people are mostly busy with vague comparisons in terms of money and wealth. That's why the rate of anxiety and depression is high in societies. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a shorter speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
It does actually, in their opinion, violate civil liberties, existing civil liberties of society. And of course, with the backdrop of COVID and the draconian measures, and on the back of 20 years of increased police powers after the anti-terrorism laws, etc., that have come in to counter terrorism, there's a sort of nervousness.
And here is why it matters. Women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government.
There is a general trend for government to grab more and more power and to reduce civil liberties. This is what's worrying. I think that the Lords ultimately, as you say, won't be able to stop it entirely. They can slow the process down, water it down slightly. But if governments are inexorably marching towards a greater totalitarian orientated set of legislature, then I'm afraid that at the moment, with the climate the way it is, politically, economically, etc., I don't think it'll be terribly difficult for them to push it through.
Campaigners say the parliamentary defeat came because people took to the streets and raised the alarm about the government's growing authoritarianism. They say it is now time to build the movement and kill the contentious bill once and for all. Saeed Purreza, London.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention in Israeli jails. The protest comes as hundreds of inmates have already boycotted Israel's military court, demanding an end to its illegal administrative detention. About 500 administrative detainees began the new year by refusing to show up for their court sessions.
Israeli regime has renewed administrative detention against hundreds of Palestinian inmates. Palestinians and human rights groups should do their best to put an end to the cruel policy. We stand by our brothers in Israeli jails who have boycotted Israel's military court. We also call on international human rights organizations to take a serious action.
The boycott of Israel's military court by Palestinian inmates comes as the health of the Palestinian hunger striker Nasser Abu Hamid is deteriorating. He has been in a coma for 11 days while in custody. Palestinian factions say the intentional medical negligence practiced by Israeli regime aims at killing the Palestinian prisoners.
Our message is clear. We will always support our detainees who stand against the brutal policies of the Israeli regime. Our brother Nasser Abu Hamid is in coma for 11 days due to medical negligence as Israel refuses to release him to provide him with proper medication. This amounts to a criminal act against our prisoners.
Public protests are mounting day by day against Israel's decision not to release Nasser Abu Hamid. Palestinians say they will hold Israel accountable if the inmate dies.
About 500 Palestinian detainees are refusing to show up for their court sessions, saying that this move is aimed at putting an end to the illegal Israeli administrative detention policy. They are also demanding the release of the hunger-striking prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, who's on the verge of death. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Strikes, protests, and parliamentary disunity have shown that opposition to President Emmanuel Macron's pandemic policies have reached unprecedented levels. Macron dominates his party, and his party dominates Parliament. But France's controversial new vaccine smart pass was only just approved after more than 2 weeks of parliamentary chaos. It's one of the strictest vaccine passes in the world because it requires full vaccination. The vaccine hesitant can no longer provide proof of a negative COVID test
to avoid almost total public isolation. There have been weeks of protests in favor of the rights of the non-vaccinated, and unions are planning enormous walkouts against a pandemic response which is accused of being imposed from above and without enough grassroots input.
In the end, it was Macron who decided alone, and that's why it's a bit confused for everyone. So, and that's why it makes a lot of confusion in the population, because just one guy who decides everything and a scientific committee who is more a justification for the decision that has been taken.
Vaccines in France are popular. 80% of the formerly vaccine-skeptical nation is now fully vaccinated. That has many saying that seemingly scapegoating the unvaccinated is a way for Macron to solidify a precarious re-election bid.
Despite his immensely controversial tenure, Macron retains a hardcore base of support of around 20%. It's been long assumed that it will be enough to get him into the second round, where he will defeat a challenger from the far right, like in 2017.
The decision is are very influenced by the fact that the election are coming in April. So it's really difficult to go to the mandatory vaccination for Emmanuel Macron. Maybe he want to wait for his re-election to go from the vaccinal pass to the mandatory vaccination.
The vaccine pass will likely be contested in France's top court, but it is expected to go into effect this week. The Omicron variant is far less deadly than previous versions, giving hope that the pandemic is ending. But it appears that the nation's pandemic policies will be a major part of the presidential election this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Genocide, the deliberate destruction of an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. There have been many, with death tolls in the millions, and the threat of another is always around the corner. Organizations like the IHRC are fighting to prevent that by raising awareness. The theme of this year's event, how do states sanitize genocide?
Genocide is sanitized. It's not only the genocidal state which actively attempts to sanitize its crimes. Other states are also actively involved. Those which supply the weapons and other instruments of annihilation. Those which refuse to acknowledge or call out the genocide for fear of the obligations to prevent and punish the crimes taking place that they would be placed under. Those which fear offending trading partners.
There are more than 1,500 monuments across London, commemorating everyone from controversial figures like Churchill to even fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes. But you would be hard-pressed to find a monument that commemorated the 1 million people killed in the Great Irish Famine, a genocide orchestrated by the British.
The British government conveniently omits England's role in bringing about genocides like the so-called potato famine from school books, like many other regimes that weave history in a way that justifies crimes against humanity.
Here's a real chance for the UK government and the Department for Education to truly celebrate, or rather I should say commemorate, the diverse groups of people that it can encourage our systems and our schools to remember because of who their predecessor governments have exterminated in previous centuries, whether we're talking about the indigenous people of Australia, Malays, Chinese, Indian subcontinent, Iranians, Iraqis.
Genocide Memorial Day is held on the anniversary of Israel's Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to 2009, which killed hundreds of Palestinians. Again in 2021, thousands of Palestinians were killed at the hands of the Israeli regime, which legitimizes its actions by evoking another genocide, the Holocaust. The vicious cycle continues, and therefore, so must the fight against dehumanization and ethnic cleansing. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shabwa earlier this month and made advances toward Madlib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles. The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed. While a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place.
Now the Philomoy School has opened for students in Afghanistan to facilitate learning. This Iranian platform provides Afghan students with free educational courses.
Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses.
Hello everyone, how are you?
Now they are students of Philomoy School and they are happy with everything it has provided.
It has been almost 152 days that we have been away from school. We felt very desperate. In order to stay involved with education, my friends and I gather here and benefit from Philomoy School's online courses. The lessons and videos provided by Philomoy are very interesting and creative.
Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Philomoy Online School very professional and useful for Afghan students.
I found the Philomoy School extraordinarily useful, especially for Afghan students who are affected by political crisis and the coronavirus pandemic. This is very valuable academically too. I'm sure our students highly welcome Philomoy School because they are in need of such opportunities.
Philomoy School says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl from preschool to the 9th grade can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Nakab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
There was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution, it's a delusion. And it's an illusion that was instituted by Ben-Gurion in the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. And all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defense ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe costs in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace, all of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners, dear brothers and sisters all around the world. I am Atan, the host of the program Viewpoints, and this series of the program Viewpoints is concerned with the thoughts and works and opinions of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali Alevian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So we were enumerating some of the most outstanding features of Islam and Nabi Muhammadi, mainly and roughly translated into English as the pure Muhammadan Islam. What are the ways in order to reach to the original Islam based on the thoughts of leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei? In our previous discussion, we discussed about Islam based on the Holy Quran and the Sunnah, and we enumerated and we elaborated on that. In this episode, inshallah, we want to talk about Islam, the religion of jihad and martyrdom and shahada. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, nowadays the term jihad and martyrdom are misinterpreted among the people all around the world. And whenever you are talking about the jihad, the first things that comes to our mind, or when you Google even the term jihad, is suicide bombing first, and the second one is jihad nikah, or the marriage jihad, which was coined after ISIS. Unfortunately, two deviated definitions out of the term jihad. First of all, define for us what is jihad and what is the importance of jihad, and we say that jihad is one of the main features of Islam and Muhammad.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As we are referring to the Quran itself, according to the speech of the Supreme Leader, that in order to get the Islam, you need to go back to the original source, which is Quran and the Sunnah. In the Quran, the word jihad has been used in two ways. One is to struggle and in the path of Allah. This struggle has the overall meaning. Like, for example, struggling in order to have the halal rizq, for example. Struggling for your family, for yourself, in order to have sustenance. Or in order to pray, for example. Even in your prayers, when you struggle, this is known as jihad. This is known as jihad as well. So this is the one of the meanings that has been used in the verses of the Quran. There is another meaning of the jihad, which is basically fighting, which is more prominent in today's world, basically, because of these things that were going on. In the Quran, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking about the jihad, He also talks about the struggling in the right path. That can be any struggle in the right path in order to reach to the perfection. That is also known as jihad. There is another jihad, which is the minor jihad. And this minor jihad is fighting. And in the Islam, in the life of Prophet, we see that this fighting jihad had a defensive mode, basically. Whenever enemies...
Defensive mode. That's right.
Okay. Whenever enemies attacked Islam, or they planned to attack the Muslimin or the Muslims of that time.
That's right.
At that time, in order to protect the Muslim lands or the cities or other Muslims, the Prophet came and stopped them. And obviously, in stopping that, those enemies, there was a fight. That's at right. different places.
And at the beginning, they said that Prophet Muhammad used to perform a kind of proclamation, advising them, suggesting them, introducing the ayahs of the Holy Quran.
Ayahs of the Holy Quran.
And then upon the defensive mode, he defended himself.
He defended himself. Okay. So in Islam, in the life of Prophet, what we see was a struggle in order to save your country, your people.
Based on peace.
Your nation. Based on peace.
That's right.
This jihad that we see today, the way you gave example of ISIS and all those.
Yes.
This all started after the demise of the Prophet, which is not the sunnah of the Prophet. We need to make clear that when we are talking about the pure Muhammadan Islam, we need to even see jihad in the life of the Prophet.
Yes.
And in the life of the Prophet, there is an infallible who orders for the jihad, and that is in the defensive mode. For example, we can give an example of this time if you want to see jihad. There was a fatwa of jihad in this time, and that was given by Ayatollah Sistani.
Right.
When the ISIS attacked Iraq, he gave an order, a fatwa of the jihad, that the people of Iraq should protect their country.
That's right.
He did not set to invade a country. For example, during the eight-year wars that we had, the Iran and Iraq wars was at that time.
Yes.
Even at that time, there was a point when the Iranian forces, they by themselves, they planned and they went towards the Basra of the Iraq, and they got the factory of the salt and all those.
Yes.
When Imam Khomeini knew about this, Imam Khomeini called them back.
Yes, he said, ordered them to be back, yes.
To come back.
Yes, yes.
Why? Because in Islam, invasion is not there. Expanding the land is not there in order to just attack and get the land on the basis
and loot
of
the country, that's
loot
right.
the country.
Okay.
This is not the part of Islam.
That's right.
So basically, when Islam talks about the jihad, we have two types of jihad.
Yes.
The inner jihad, which is the major, or you can say like the greater jihad.
Jihad-e-Akbar. That's right.
And there is a minor jihad, which is smaller, and obviously the outer jihad.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen. Brother Ali, let's get to you. Now, etymologically speaking, so many words are taken out of the word jihad, and you can find them on the social media nowadays and on the news and the media. And that is, for example, jihadists or mujahid. All of them, according to linguistic researchers, have negative connotations, unfortunately. And this is what the discourse analysts do on the media and the excerpts of the news, that jihad, mujahid, and jihadists are all of them connotated with something like terrorism, suicide bombing, attacking here and there, and all of that. And unfortunately, this is what getting us away from what leader said, Islam and Nabi Muhammadi. I mean, a term or a concept is, first of all, misinterpreted for you. Even the sad news is that among the Muslims, the term jihad and the jihadists and the mujahids are connotated with the, we can say, negative meanings. What is the reason for this and where the problem is?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Yes, you know, jihad is a sacred and important concept in Islam, and it has been misinterpreted. And the reason, I think, is quite clear, because it is that important that needs to be